Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We hear from Middle East expert Norman Finkelstein. He spoke at the University of Connecticut April 7th as he talks about the history of Israeli policies leading to attacks on Gaza that began December 27th, generating massive world protests. In addition to attacks on a UN compound where 700 civilians were seeking sanctuary, Israeli troops also bombed a UN school, killing some 40 people, many of them children. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Physicians for Human Rights Israel, and many other groups are calling for investigations into Israel's attacks on heavily populated civilian areas, their direct attacks on women and children, and attacks on emergency medical teams as they tried to apply life-saving techniques. A growing number of people worldwide have offered the assessment that the Israeli state was itself harmed by its own actions in Gaza, though the U.S. under Barack Obama has thus far continued to resupply Israel with heavy weapons, despite requests from Amnesty International that they not do so, pending an investigation. First, we're joined on the phone by Dr. Saeed Agari, an emergency medical specialist who recently returned from Gaza, where he helped treat wounded after Israeli air and ground attacks. Dr. Saeed Agari, Yes. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Now, I know even before the airstrikes in December and January, there were calls coming from the UN, the special rapporteur that we interviewed, Richard Falk, explaining that the civilian population of Gaza was starving.
The siege and the blockade that it has been inflicted upon them has created a human disaster to the level of barbarian level. It has destructed their infrastructure. It has destroyed their municipal buildings, airports, hospitals, schools, mosques, markets and bazaars, their academies, their universities, and immense number of homes, residential homes. And as we all know, has killed thousands of people and it has wounded uncountable number of people. The numbers we have are not really correct. It's much more because of the situation they live in. Deficiency of water, their water system was not efficient to begin with, and because of the blockade and the siege, and also this most recent attack, it has dismantled it even more.
Doctor, were you able to help at all with any of the victims during the time that you were in Gaza?
I teamed up with the doctors of the Shafa Hospital and Ghouta Hospital and Rafah Hospital. Those are the main hospitals in Gaza. We helped what we could. They have very good doctors over there. And what they are suffering from is a lack of import of medicine and medical devices. And of course, they are very open to have any kind of international delegations of medical help. They are open to that.
When were you in Gaza, Dr. Agari, and were you welcomed by the Hamas government or by the people of Gaza?
Yes, we went with a delegation on March 1st last month from United States, different states. We had difficulty to enter Gaza because of the government of Egypt. We had to stay at the border for several days and nights with some protests. But finally we got in, fortunately, with persistence. And entering Gaza was a different world. They welcomed us by media, by a minister of health, and they welcomed us everywhere. They gave us place to stay. They fed us. You know, they arranged transportation for us with all the difficulties that they have. But it's an eye-opener. And because I'm from Middle East myself, the hospitality of these people was so immense that brought tears in our eyes.
Now, what kinds of injuries were coming in? I mean, we heard in the U.S. from Physicians for Human Rights Israel that children were shot, but also medical workers were getting wounded. What kinds of wounds did you see and could you document?
Yes, there has been thousands of amputees, and a lot of those amputations are not sharp ones. They are because of the phosphorus bomb, and because of the crumbling of the building, because this attack, a lot of people have been in the residential buildings, and because of the collapse of those buildings, which they are made from cement and steel, a lot of those happened because of the crushed amputation. We saw many, many, many of those. And also a lot of them have been because of the phosphorus bombs and the immense bombings that they did because of the explosions. A tremendous amount of burns, a lot of, you know, eye injuries, ear injuries. The war casualties that I had seen before, I had never seen anything to this extent, because this apparently was not a battle zone. It was what it seemed like, military against civilians. What I witnessed myself, along with my brother doctors from Gaza, was we saw a lot of injuries because of the bombings by F-16, from the shellings by tanks and helicopters, and also we saw casualties from white phosphorus, which those injuries, they last. It keeps going for several weeks. And because these are new, it needs more medical research to find out how long it's going to last and what's going to be the outcomes in future. But they look pretty intense and very medically very, very complicated and hard to treat, because it causes burns from the skin to the inner tissues, including muscles and ligaments and fascia and bone and even internal organs. On top of that, what I noticed as an emergency physician is 1.5 million Gazans, they all, without exception, they are traumatized emotionally and severely, and they suffer from post-traumatic trauma, especially women and children. So with children and youth and women, we saw tremendous amount of crying and depression and anger, and the sense of hopelessness, and they were telling us that we are forgotten and the world community doesn't care about us. But we had to say, no, that's not true. We do care. People of the United States, some of them do care about you, and some of them are aware that what's happening. That's why we are here. And yes, we did help, because in our delegation and team, we had social workers, family doctors, emergency doctor, myself. Unfortunately, we didn't have a psychiatrist with us, but next delegation, we are going to take one with us. Yes, they do need help for emergencies, for children care, and especially psychiatric health. More than that, they really need clean water to drink and enough food to eat. They are suffering from anemia and malnutrition. We can look at those as medical problems, or we can look at them as human rights and the basics of nutrition. As a physician with social responsibilities, I think that's a political issue and a humanitarian issue rather than medical. It causes medical problems, but the treatment is not really medicine. Treatment is clean water and enough food, which, because of the blockage and siege, they can't get enough.
Dr. Saeed Aghari, I know you're speaking in the Connecticut area about your trip to Gaza. Just tell our listening audience why people should come to this lecture and what they would find out if they did.
I would like to say, as a human being, we all have responsibility for each other around the world. And we took responsibility to go over there, and I witnessed ourselves what's going on over there, and not to be just with the numbers we have read and the few pictures we have seen. I have some CDs and pictures to show a drop of an ocean of what has happened on land of Gaza, which is tremendously more than what we have heard or seen or talked about here. And I think it's worthwhile to go through that, and the listeners can use their own judgment of what I have to say or what kind of picture I can show them. These pictures are going to be from universities and hospitals from Gaza, not from any kind of news agencies with some sort of international interest in it. I think they speak for themselves.
Thank you so much for taking time away from your busy clinic work to speak with us.
Thank you.
We turn next to part one of Norman Finkelstein's talk at the University of Connecticut campus, April 7th.
The topic I'm going to speak about this afternoon is the events that unfolded in Gaza between December 27th and January 18th, those 22 days, which I suspect are pretty fresh in the minds of most of you. And the first order of business is to come up with the right words or phrase to, as a shorthand, describe what happened. It's often called in the media, in the mainstream media, it's often called a war, the Gaza War. And the first order of business, as I said, is to decide whether or not that's an accurate term or whether we can come up with a better one. So let's begin with the basic facts. Israel flew about 3,000 combat missions over Gaza during those 22 days. None of the planes were damaged. None of the planes were downed for the simple reason that the Palestinian resistance had no anti-aircraft defenses to speak of. Israel then launched a ground invasion of Gaza, but there were no major battles. There were no major clashes during the ground invasion, mostly because Israel was equipped with very sophisticated night fighting technology, which the resistance in Gaza didn't have on its side. The Palestinians were not able to fight at night, and so there was basically bullets and an artillery flying in one direction, but not the other direction. As a respected Israeli strategic analyst put it after the events in Gaza, he said it is very dangerous for the Israelis to believe they won the war when there was no war. In reality, not a single battle was fought during the 22 days of fighting. This is not a war. It is not even a real battle. And the actual figures, the raw numbers, suggest that what this analyst said is correct. On one side, on the Palestinian side, the best figures we now have are 1,450 Palestinians were killed, of whom approximately 83%, about 980 Palestinians, were civilians, about 311 were children. On the other side, on the Israeli side, there were 13 casualties, of whom 3 were civilians, 10 were combatants, and of those 10 combatants, about half were killed due to friendly fire, that is, Israeli soldiers accidentally shooting Israeli soldiers. Overall, the ratio was about a little over 100 to 1. For every 100 Palestinians killed, 1 Israeli was killed. If you look at what actually happened, and you look at the raw figures, plainly it was not a war, if by any reasonable definition of war you mean people firing at each other from both sides. There was one side firing on another side, and one side basically annihilating the other side. That's not a war. It can be called a bloodbath, it can be called a massacre, but it doesn't seem to me by any reasonable definition what happened in Gaza can be described as a war. So, for the remainder of my remarks this afternoon, I'll be referring to the Gaza massacre, not for its emotional value and not to prejudice the outcome of my remarks in my favor, linguistically prejudice them, but simply because that seems to me a much more accurate description of what happened. Israel officially justified the Gaza massacre on the grounds that it was self-defense against Hamas rocket attacks, the attacks that were being launched from the Gaza Strip. That justification lacked any credibility, any believability, because if Israel wanted to prevent the rocket attacks from Gaza, it wouldn't have broken the ceasefire which triggered those rocket attacks. Israel also had the option, up until the beginning of the massacre, it also had the option of renewing the ceasefire which it broke with Hamas, but it chose not to renew the ceasefire. Israel also had the option, an option which has existed, as I'll try to show later on, an option which has existed for decades. Israel had the option of reaching a negotiated settlement with the Palestinians, including Hamas, and ending all armed hostilities. Israel has rejected that option as well. For the moment, I want to look at the human rights picture just before Israel launched the massacre in Gaza. The main Israeli human rights organization is called Human Rights Organization for the Occupied Territories is called B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. And a few weeks ago, they released their annual report on the human rights situation in the West Bank and Gaza. They limited themselves to the period January 1st, 2008, to December 26, 2008. So all of the remarks I'm about to quote from them do not include the Gaza massacre. It's the period right before the massacre begins. They say that for that period, Israel killed 455 Palestinians, January 1st to December 26th. Israel killed 455 Palestinians, of whom at least 175 were civilians. On the Israeli side, 31 persons were killed, of whom about 21 were civilians. Thus, just before Israel, with its so-called war of self-defense, the total number of Palestinians to Israelis killed was 15 to 1. If we limit ourselves strictly to civilians, the ratio was 9 Palestinians killed for every Israeli killed during the year 2008. If we now limit ourselves strictly to Gaza, 158 Palestinian civilians were killed in 2008. 7 Israeli civilians were killed, a ratio of 20 Palestinian civilians killed in Gaza for each Israeli killed in the year 2008. Some of you will know that Israel has loudly protested that Hamas is keeping prisoner a single Israeli soldier, a person whose name has become quite well known, Corporal Shalit. What's less well known is that as Hamas keeps one Israeli soldier prisoner, Israel keeps, as we speak now, approximately 11,000 Palestinians prisoner. Of those 11,000 Palestinians being held by Israel, 548 are administrative detainees. That means they're being held without any charges or any trial. And of those 548, 42 have been held without charges or trial for more than 2 years. But all we hear about is Corporal Shalit. In addition, according to the B'Tselem, describing the picture more generally, it said in the past year, Israel has tightened its sweeping restrictions on the freedom of movement of Palestinian residents in the West Bank, expanded its illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank, which now house 500,000 illegal Jewish settlers. It's confiscated more West Bank land, causing, in the words of B'Tselem, serious harm to Palestinians who are no longer able to work their land and gain a livelihood from it. It's prevented any possibility of development and construction in Palestinian communities. Israel continues to discriminatorily distribute water. The settler population, the indigenous population of the West Bank is about 9 times the settler population, but the total water allocation for the indigenous population is less than the water allocation for the 500,000 illegal Jewish settlers. In addition, Israel continues to build a wall in the West Bank, which illegally annexes to Israel approximately 12% of Palestinian land, even though the highest judicial body in the world, the International Court of Justice, has ruled that the wall is illegal and has to be dismantled. The current phase of the conflict, generally said to begin in January 2006, when Hamas won in what were called back then the freest and fairest elections ever held in the Arab world. Now, that admittedly is not a very high standard. It's along the lines of the tallest building in Plains, Georgia. But nonetheless, the fact is they won the elections, they were free, and they were fair, at least as all international monitors said at the time. And to my knowledge, nobody has disputed. In June 2007, Israel's reaction after the Hamas was elected in those freest and fairest elections in the Arab world, Israel's reaction was to impose a brutal economic siege, blockade of Gaza, a siege, a blockade which, under international law, as Human Rights Watch said, is illegal and a serious violation of international law. A serious violation is a war crime. In June 2007, the United States, Israel, and some elements of the Palestinian community tried to overthrow Hamas in a coup. Hamas preempted the coup, and the Israeli collaborators were forced to flee. At that time, after the coup attempt, Israel and the United States were yet more enraged, and they tightened that brutal economic siege, that illegal siege of Gaza. By December 2008, the picture was quite bleak. We're now talking about on the eve of Israel's massacre in Gaza. The picture was quite bleak. The main UN organization working in the area is called the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, and they published a study in the second week in December entitled "The Impact of the Blockade on the Gaza Strip, a Human Dignity Crisis." And they said that the 18-month-long blockade has created a profound human dignity crisis, leading to a widespread erosion of livelihoods and a significant deterioration in infrastructure and essential services. Because of the blockade, Gazans were left without electricity for 16 hours a day. They were able to receive water only once a week for a few hours. Nearly 50% of the population was unemployed. 50% of the population was food insecure. 20% of essential drugs were left at zero level. 20% of patients suffering from cancer, heart disease, and other severe conditions were denied the right to get medical care abroad. OCHA concludes that many Palestinians report a growing sense of being trapped physically, intellectually, and emotionally. If you look at the overall human rights picture just on the eve of the Israeli attack, it seems to me the record shows that the Palestinians had a much stronger case than Israel for resorting to armed force and self-defense at the end of December 2008. Leaving that aside, why did Israel attack? It wasn't the rocket attacks, obviously, because they trigger the rocket attacks. And even after triggering them, they could have had a ceasefire with Hamas, but avoided it. When the massacre began, there was a lot of speculation in Israel, and to some extent here in the United States as well, that the main motive was the upcoming Israeli election. The different parties were vying in the election for the highest offices, and the thought was, well, killing Arabs is always a crowd pleaser in Israel, so if you launch an attack, a massacre, you will be able to garner more votes. It is true that during the Gaza massacre, the support among Israeli Jews hovered around 90%, 90, 91% gave their full support to Israel as it proceeded to annihilate the Palestinians. But it's probably untrue, in my opinion, that the Israeli elections were the main factor, because Israeli elites, like ruling elites anywhere in the world, they're very loyal to their state, and they're not going to jeopardize crucial state interests just for the sake of winning an election. That would be irresponsible, and Israeli elites, like most elites, are not irresponsible when it comes to key issues of power. The Gaza operation was obviously a major one for Israel, and they're not going to undertake it merely for the sake of trying to get votes. Israel sometimes, you know, conducts foreign adventures, just like the United States often does, for electoral reasons, but not when major interests are at stake. An obvious case in the example, in the instance of the United States, which is somewhat relevant, in 1983, when Ronald Reagan suffered a major setback when 240 Marines were killed in Lebanon, and it didn't look good for the president, the first thing he did, as some of you who are older in the room will remember, the first thing he did was invade Grenada. You know, Grenada was no major national interest, so why not just go in to Grenada and distract attention from what happened in Lebanon? And Israel does the same thing. So in 1981, there was a fellow who was running for office named Menachem Begin, and Mr. Begin decided to bomb the Oserak reactor in Iraq. The claim was it was involved then in making nuclear weapons. In fact, there's exactly zero evidence that it was involved in making nuclear weapons, and quite the contrary, all the evidence shows that it was because Begin attacked the Oserak reactor that Saddam Hussein embarked on his nuclear weapons program. So if it wasn't the election and it wasn't the rocket attacks, why did they launch the massacre? In my opinion, it's basically two reasons. One, because Israel had to restore what it calls its deterrence capacity. And two, because the Palestinians were becoming, in particular Hamas, they were becoming too moderate. They were becoming too reasonable. They were wanting to settle the conflict diplomatically. And for Israel, this was a veritable catastrophe, a catastrophe that can only be averted by trying to overturn or displace Hamas.
Middle East expert and scholar Norman Finkelstein speaking at the University of Connecticut, April 7th. There were four campus organizations supporting Professor Finkelstein's talk: the Arab Cultural Association, the Muslim Students Association, Ideals United, and the Iranian Students Association. Aaron Frankel was the coordinator. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.